שלח לכו אנשים ויסור את ארץ כנען אשר אני נתן לבני ישראל. אז איתה דבו? עוד. Send our men that they may search the land of Canaan which I give unto the children of Israel. We all know Rashi's quotation from the Tanhumeh pertaining to this passage. Lomo nismocho parshas meragvim le parshas miriam. That's where the Tanhumeh asks. Ufi shalokso aliske dibro, she dibro beyochiyo, ushoyim alolu rolu veleilok humusa. Why is this section dealing with the Meraglim put in juxtaposition with the section dealing with Miriam's punishment? Because the previous part, the last parsha in Balesko, tells us about the Miriam episode. To show the grievousness of the spy's sin, Miriam was punished on account of the slander of Lashon Hara, which she uttered against her brother. And these sinners mean the Meraglim, witnessed it, and yet they did not take a lesson from her. In order to understand it is a simple Tanhume and it's also a complex Tanhume. I mean, at surface, prima facie, Tanhume is very simple. Probably Tanhume should be explored in depth. In order to understand the words of the Tanhume, it is indispensable to explore the Miriam incident in depth. What exactly happened with Miriam? Why was she punished? What actually did happen? What complicates the situation is a pasuk verse in Kisaitse, in Deuteronomy. The biblical passage in Kisaitse says, in this biblical passage, we are warned not to forget what happened to Miriam on their way from Egypt to Eretz Israel. Every Jew or a Jew who recites the six schiras, there are six schiras in Siddur, I believe, yes? Amorek and Shabbos and Yetzias Mitzrayim and Miriam and Matan Torah, correct? A Jew recites the six schiras daily is acquainted with the text. Chayir es asher osu ad Hashem lekecho lemiryom baderech v'teischen in Yisrael. Remember what God did unto Miriam when you were on the way from Mitzrayim to the promised land. Rashi in Kiseite interprets the verse Zochir in terms of Lashon Hara. Remember and don't engage in slander or in gossip. A Jew must not speak slander against another Jew the way Miriam did it concerning Moshe. It is quite difficult to understand why the Torah has singled out Lashon Hara to warn us against it. In what respect, I mean, I'm asking a question. In what respect does Lashon Hara differ from other mitzvahs concerning human relations, mitzvahs shebein odom lachaverei, such as the prohibition against perjury, stealing, taking revenge, shaming somebody? Why was it necessary to place special emphasis upon Lashon Hara? So Rashi says, why did the Torah deem it necessary to include the incident of Miriam among the greatest events in Jewish history, such as the Sabbath, Zohar Sima Shabbat Rekatshe, the Exodus, Mantisko Simtisra Mertin Franklin Achayecho, or revelation at Mount Sinai, Chayr al tishkeches advorim asher oren echo, which one must always remember, is an episode, prima facie, actually insignificant. I mean, you read about Miriam says, consider, all right, it was a passing episode. But why should we remember that forever? The way a Jew was told to remember the Sabbath, to remember the Exodus, to remember the revelation at Mount Sinai. Apparently, that the Miriam episode is just an important event, as Mohammed Samolek, yeah, I forgot before Mohammed Samolek, as Mohammed Samolek, or Yitzias Mitzrayim, or Matan Terah, or creation of the world by the Almighty. The Terah, I mean, told us to remember. The Sabbath, Mohammed Samolek, Matan Terah, Yitzias Mitzrayim, but it's also told us to remember the incident of the Miriam episode. The answer to this problem, we have got to understand it. The answer to this problem lies somewhere else, I believe. In order to understand it, we have to analyze, actually, the Miriam episode and find out what did the error on the part of Aaron and Miriam consist. What did Miriam accuse Moshe of, actually? Even I wish to insert here a parenthetic remark. I mean, it's not in my manuscript, it's completely not. It's from extemporaneous. Certainly you know, or you all know, that the Rambam in his introduction to Zroim and his classification of Teirosh Baal Peh has a separate section, what he calls Pirushim Amkubolim Meisher Rabbeinu. Means interpretation of the Pentateuch, which were transmitted to us by Moshe. But the Rambam wants to say there that there is all that we must interpret the text the way the Maaseh of the Kabbalah has accepted, told us to. Usually we have quite unlimited freedom in interpreting psukim in the Torah. We may interpret kipshutei, we may interpret kemidroshei. There's so many ways in which we can interpret and understand and comprehend the Torah. However, with regard to certain parshas, we don't enjoy the freedom of interpretation as much as we do enjoy concerning other parshas. For instance, the Rambam gives an example. Ayin Tachasayin, Chazal have interpreted, Momen Tachasayin, compensation. Monetary compensation for an injury, not injury for injury. What if someone, says, all right, this is the aloche, this is medroshe, but why shouldn't I, who teaches little children, Shilektaneo, many other schools translate the words literally, ayin tachat ayin, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. I have no right. If I should do it, my interpretation will be heretic. Because I have no right to interpret in a manner which differs from the Kabbalah. The Rambam quotes another parsha. Ukachtem lochem bayim arishin priyitod or kapes norim vanat eitzod eitzor venochav. So someone will interpret the pasuk, a pri etzodah means any beautiful fruit, any pleasant fruit, not effort. And now the nochah will say, anat etzovis, you interpret in terms of another culture, not the mertu. According to Rambam, he has no right, and if he should do so, he'll commit a basic error. It would be a heresy. Rambam is the Katesis Kapo, the Rambam. Should cut off her hand. Chazal interpreted the Katesis Kapo, she should stay basic because she shamed him. What if a teacher or a rabbi should translate the Katesis Kapo literally, not bait him, to cut off her hand? He's an apicurus, according to Rambam. You have no right, with regard to Rushin and Kubol and Meshe, means that certain parashas in Satere We cannot interpret in Shivim Ponim or in so many ways. There is only one way of interpretation and translation, namely, the Derech HaKabbalah. So I want to help my father, in the name of Rav Chaim, at the Parshas Miriam, the Ram didn't mention it, Rav Chaim said, at the Parshas Miriam belongs into the category, of the Rushim and Kabbalah and Meshur Rabbeinu. If one should interpret Parshas Miriam, the issue of Kushis Loka, that he took, he married an Ethiopian woman, is a case of the Meshur Rabbeinu over there. This parsha we don't enjoy any freedom. There's only one translation and one interpretation. If you accept it, it's all right. If not, you have no right to teach. So how did Chazal interpret that the Daber Miriam, the Aaron, the Meshe? The Aaron, the Meshe, a lady, so Isha Akushis, Asha Lokoch, Ki Isha Kushis Lokoch. How do Chazal? That's the three, that's the only pshat. We have no right, to introduce any other interpretation or new idea. What's the Kisha Kushis Lokach? Kushis means Tzipora. It's his wife whom he married when he came to Yetro so many years ago. Why is she called Kushis? What do you say? She Yofok Kushis, she was unique, singular. Because the word, the trouble is many modern commentators of the Bible, simply don't know the semantics of the Hebrew language, and that's why they arrive quite often at radical conclusions. The word Kushi means Ethiopian, Kushi perhaps means black, Negro, but Kushi means also unique. Alekivnei Kushim atemli means you are a unique people. So Kiisha Kushis Lokach, as Rashi says, she was beautiful. I mean, she was unique, singular, in her appearance, in her beauty, as well as in her virtue and character. That the Daber Miriam Ve'Aren, the Meshe, a lady said, Isha Akushis Asher Lokach, and how do Chazal say Asher Lokach? No, so what's wrong? Asher Lokach Ve'Girish. He divorced her. He separated from the woman. Because the Kodesh Baruch Hu told them in Sinai, a male, and we find in the Pasuk Reshchanan, a male lohem, shuvu le'olechem, v'ato peya meidemori. It means the Kodesh Baruch Hu told Moses, v'ato peya meidemori, stay with me, means you have to withdraw from family, wife, and children. You are dedicated wholly and completely to me. Other people, then go back to their jobs, to their home, and live like ordinary human beings. But Meshi is different. Meshi was elevated at Matan Torah to transcendental height. He could not return to an earthly life. An earthly life. He could not return. So, Al Dvar Yisho, the Meshi, Al Edis, Yisho Akushis, the Kushite woman means the unique, beautiful, woman, Asher Lokach, Ve'Girish, it means that he married and he should have continued the marriage, but however, he did not act like that. He withdrew from her, either separated or simply divorced her. They consider that the separation, Moses' separation from Tzipporah, was unnecessary and unfair. If you remember the Rashi, the trouble is that you don't study the Rashi and it comes to a difficult parsha. Rashi says how it developed because the women, the wives of Elder Tomatoes say, Tzipporah said about the wives of Elder Tomatoes, now they will be divorced. And so that's how Miriam overheard the conversation, and that's why she complained bitterly against her brother. What did Miriam and Aaron say? What did they say? How did they argue the case against Moses? How did they argue? They argued the case. So perhaps HaKadosh Baruch Hu told him to divorce her. Perhaps it was done in accordance with the instructions from the Almighty. So they said, Vayemru, Arak Bemeshe Diber Adeshem, Alegam Bonne Diber. For has the Lord spoken with him only, alone? Has he not spoken to with us as well? And we were not told to separate from our spouses. So why did he do it? We are all prophets. Why is his conduct different from ours? This was the problem. What did HaKadosh Baruch Hu tell them? He told them something. Vayemer Shimon Advorai, Im Yien Ivyachem Adeshem, Damare Ela Vesvado, Vachaleim Adaba Bey, Lekin Avdi Meshe Bechol Bey Kinemanu, Peel Pe Adaba Bey, Umare Velei Bechideis. Usmuna Sadeshem Yavit. This is prima facie, has no relationship to the problem. They didn't deny that Moshe was the greatest. They did not say that Moshe was superior to them. They said that separation was unnecessary. So how did HaKadosh Baruch Hu meet this argument? In what consisted the error which Miriam and Aaron committed? In their failure to understand one thing. What? What didn't they understand? HaKadosh Baruch Hu corrected. What didn't they understand? What did they fail to understand? Yes? Correct. Moshe not only was the greatest, not only was the most perfect, he was the kindest, the saintliest. Of course, he was. But he was something else. Namely, he was different. Completely different. Miriam and Aaron were not aware of the incongruity and the incommensurability of Moses' prophecy with the prophecies of other Nevi'im. They knew that Moses was the greatest, the most outstanding, the teacher of all prophets. However, they did not grasp Moses' singularity, or I would say singleness, and Adonai. Moses being completely different, totally at variance with Adonai. Failing to see Moses' aloneness and singleness, they argued, in the Moshe Bilvad Diber Adeshem, Ale Gambonu Diber. Has not the Almighty spoken to us? And yet, he has never told us to separate or to withdraw from our spouses? Apparently, that the Almighty disapproves a life of abstention. So why did Moses separate? What did he fail to see? That whatever they do is not characteristic of Moses. And Moses enjoys a separate status. Not only as the greatest, as the teacher, as the most perfect, as the kindest, as the simplest, more than that, a separate status, which is beyond and above comparison. A certain rule applicable to Miriam and to Aaron might be out of context vis-a-vis Moses. As a matter of fact, the Rambam, Nechesisede Atere, speaks about the Nevuah of other Nevi'im, and he also deals with Nevuah of Moshe. And the Rambam says that Moshe's Nevuah differed from the Nevuah for the prophets pertaining to four basic principles. However, he says, the prophecy of our teacher Moses is different. In what respect was the prophecy of Moses distinguished? In Sefer Torah, from that of other prophets, and the Rambam enumerates four things, four characteristics. All the prophets received their inspired messages in a dream or in a vision, Moses while awake and standing. As it is said, that Moses went into the tent. All the prophets received their messages through the medium of an angel. Moses received his message not through an angel, as it is said, mouth to mouth will I speak with him. The Lord spake unto Moses face to face. Furthermore, and the similitude of the Lord doth he behold. That is to say that it was no allegory that was revealed to Moses, but he realized the prophetic message clearly, without riddle, without parable. Then he has all the prophets were receiving their messages who were filled with fear and consternation and became physically weak. Not so our teacher Moses, of whom the scripture says, as a man speaketh unto a neighbor. Moses was vigorous enough to comprehend the words of prophecy while retaining his normal state. None of the prophets could prophesy at their pleasure. It was otherwise with Moses. He was invested with the prophetic spirit and was clothed with the power of prophecy whenever he pleased. There was no need for him specially to concentrate his mind and prepare for the prophetic manifestations. Is the Rambam explained? The Rambam, based upon the psukim, the verses, in our section dealing with Miriam, what HaKadosh Baruch Hu told them, and also in other passages in the Bible, so the Rambam has enumerated four basic differences between Moses and other prophets. And of course, so Moses was different, totally different. It was beyond comparison. And it comes to expression in the four words, which four words HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Leikein Avdi Moshe. Leikein Avdi Moshe. It's not only that he's supreme, that he's greater than others. He's different. Leikein Avdi Moshe, there's no comparison. Yes, there's no comparison, so your experience is not characteristic of Moshe's experience. And a rule which is applicable to Moses might not be applicable to you. So how can you say, Aragbe Moshe levade di, Aragbe Moshe diber Hashem, Alegambone diber? Diber! What's a different diber? It's a different dialogue. Moshe received the word of God in a different manner than you did receive. In a word, the chet consisted in overlooking the four words, breaking up the nation. My servant Moses is different, totally different. He is the prophet sui generis, singular and unparalleled, unmatched. As a matter of fact, the uniqueness of Moses came to expression in what? This parsha came to expression in what? None. Came to expression in a separate article of faith, in a separate ikar among these 13 ikri hadar. We say every day, Ani ma'amin shekol divrei neviim emes, and right away we add, Ani ma'amin shevuas meisher rabbeinu olav ha'sholem ha'isra amitis. Why was it necessary to add? It's called the Neviim Emes. It's called the Chemer, and they should call the Chemer. It's certainly Moses Nevui Emes. But because we had something, the Shehua Yehov, the Neviim Aboi Akedmim, the Aboi Macho. So he actually professed three things. The absolute truth of all prophecy, the absolute truth of Moses' prophecy, which is not included among called the Neviim Emes, because it's different. He is totally unique, singular. Then we said, Kol Divrei Nevi'im Emes means all prophets. But Moshe is not included. Moshe did not belong to the Hevel Nevi'im, of which we speak when we pronounce the article of faith, Kol Divrei Nevi'im Emes. Moshe was in Novi Tasei. Moses was. And secondly, that Moses' Nevi'im was different from all. He was the father of all Nevi'im. He was not only the greatest, but the only one. No one else was like him. And this is a yesod. This is fundamental in our emunah. The Rambam formulated, you know, this gemurikri. I mean, the Rambam, why did the Rambam do it? Because this is the parasha of Miriam. That's exactly why Miriam sinned and why she was punished. זוכי ראש אשר עשו עד השם מלככו למיריום בדרך. The emphasis should be placed upon what? Upon Miriam's unawareness of Moses Adames. Who was Moshe? Miriam answered, my brother the greatest. Aaron answered, my brother the greatest. No, but this is not the correct answer. The correct answer? Who was Moshe? The greatest? Yes. The simplest? Yes. The most perfect? Yes. The kindest? Yes. Etc. etc. However, Moses was something else. What? Single. Single. Unique. There was no one like him. And there'll never be someone who will be like him. He was inimitable. Incomprehensible. And what? The loneliest person on earth, because he was different from everybody. Whoever is different is lonely. Moshe is alone. Last name, who was Moshe? Called the greatest prophet. But the only prophet sui generis. The way he was. Basically, at this juncture, we come across a new idea. Namely, what idea? A new idea, very important idea in Yahadut. Basically, the cornerstone of Yahadut. The idea of Bchira. Bchira. The latter plays a central role in Yahadut. We believe that we are an Am Anifro, whoever denies Bchira, denies Yahadut. There cannot be any compromise with people who deny Bchira. If we hadn't been elected, so our worth as Jews is reduced to zero. Bchira is, and no wonder that many count of Bchira among the Ikri Hadar. We believe that we are Ama Nitro, a chosen people. What is Bchira? After the Chaton and the Kolam, you have chosen us, or you have elected us, or you have elevated us. Fine, what is it? The semantics of Bchira. What does it mean to be a chosen people? The Torah defines the concept of Bchira by equating it with what? With what? By equating it with what? Huh? Skula, correct. Correct. Im shameya tishmo bekeli, ushmartem es brisi, ve yisem li zgulo mikolo amin. What is zgulo? Zgulo is a difficult word. Logically, I mean, semantically. It's a difficult word. What does zgulo mean? We have it in Kehelis. Zgulo, I'm lochim, I'm dinit. Zgula, the way I mean, Chazal interpret, Rishonim interpret, Zgula means something special. I have, for instance, many possessions. I have many goods, many things. I have great wealth. However, a certain treasure, among many treasures, I cherish the most. One of the things I treat with special tenderness and care. I am related to the thing in a peculiar way. The relationship between me and the zgulo is singular. It cannot be determined in terms of grammatical comparison, since it is an intrinsic, there is an intrinsic qualitative difference in the relationship. Let me quote an example, and I believe the example is a correct one. Jacob loved Rachel. He loved very much Joseph. He loved certainly Leah, even though the Torah speaks that Torah Leah kisnuah. Doesn't mean he hated her, chas v'shalom. Means she was not, her, Jacob's love for her was not the same as he had, as the love he felt for Rachel. But it was not a difference in degree. Had it been a difference in degree, the Torah would not have called Leah kisnuah. It was a difference in kind. It was a different love. Of course, Jacob loved all his children. No doubt about it. We love our children. Certainly, Jacob loved his children. Reuben, Levi, Shimon, everybody. But he loved Yehuda. Joseph was this gula. Something special. There was a certain relationship between Joseph and Jacob that did not exist between Reuben and Jacob. There was a certain relationship, love, tenderness, whatever, respect, between Jacob and Rachel that did not exist between Leah and Jacob. That's why the Torah speaks, but Torah Leah kisnuah. She was hated. She did not share in the love. Not even to a lesser degree. Which Jacob gave Leah, and the other Shvatim were envious, not because it was a question of intensity. The love for Joseph was a more intense love, more intense. No, it was not a question of intensity, it was a question of kind, of quality. It was a different love. Keise Yoav Aviyah Mikol Echov does not mean Yesa Mikol Echov, as we are. Want to translate or to interpret. Means in a different manner than he loved his other son. Different, in a unique, singular. It's impossible to describe, to portray. The zgulo cannot be broken down into its component parts and analyzed in order to be analyzed. The one who knew what it and recognized it was who? It was Judah, Yehuda. In his confrontation with Joseph, Vayigash Elav Yehuda, the latter said something, V'nafshei k'shura b'nafshei. Benjamin or Joseph means, what it means, the life of Jacob who is tied up with the life of the lad, of Benjamin. In other words, the love had a personalistic quality. Namely, it resulted in a metaphysical union of souls. Nafshei k'shura b'nafshei. We have to interpret words in Tanakh, Well, there was a metaphysical union of souls. It was an existential merger. It was not just psychological love. It was existential love. Somehow, there was oneness between Joseph and Jacob, or Benjamin and Jacob. Eile, as a matter of fact, the Medrash. Eile, Tildes, Yaakov, Joseph, Ben Shvaes, Reshono, Yereyes, Echov. So the Medrash says, Eile, Tildes, Yaakov, hyphen, Joseph. It's one person. Mashir ala Yaakov ir ala Yesed. Melamed she ikunin shal Yesed deim ala Yaakov. What did Chazal attempts to, what did Chazal express by hyphenating Jacob and Joseph? The unity, the metaphysical, ontological unity of it. There were not two persons. There were one person. It's not psychological laws. It's not just a sentiment. It's not just an emotion. It's more than that. It's awareness. The Jacob in Jacob had awareness. His eye awareness of Jacob included Joseph. However, his love for his other children did not precipitate metaphysical or ontological oneness. Sentiment, deep-seated sentiment. Very intense emotion. But Jacob and Reuben did not unite. Jacob united his Yosef or Benjamin. We understand now that exactly, and Miriam failed to understand the singularity of Moses. I'm resuming, speaking of the topic. Aaron and Miriam, the very outset, did not realize the significance of the Zgula element in Moshe. They did not know that Moshe merits special attention and deserves to be treated separately. That's the reason for the Torah to warn against the sin comparing Moses with other prophets. We also understand now why the Torah, while reminding us of the Miriam episode, added the three prima facie unnecessary words, Baderech v'tzeishchem imitzroyim. Please. Why was it necessary to say? Why did Torah mention it? We all know the locus where this incident happened. We all know some chatziris. Midvatora nechatziris. Why did Torah mention the locus? Baderech v'tzeishchem imitzroyim. The Torah tried to impress upon us that the whole Exodus would not ever occur if Moses had not been the only one, the prophet and the leader beyond the reach of the imagination. If Moses had not been the different, totally other, the strangest of all, inimitable, and unmatched, the tears of triumph would have not taken place. Why? No other Novi could have represented, could have actually brought about this great miracle of tears of triumph. Only Moshe could it, because Moshe was singular. Because Moshe had the element of Zgulo. Why? Because in order to liberate the people from Ephraim, one appointment was indispensable. Namely, what appointment? To speak on behalf of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and to be his shliach, his messenger. L'chovesh l'chachor al parei ve'itzei esam ibnei Yisroel me'eret Ephraim. To be the messenger of God, only Moshe could achieve that distinction. Neither Aaron nor Miriam. Number one. Number two, why were the Jews taken out of Mitzrayim? Because not they were better. As a matter of fact, Chazal say, Alo Leizah V'Rizorah, Alo Leizah V'Rizorah, Alo Megad V'Dleiris, Alo Megad V'Dleiris. Because the Jew was different than the Mitzrayim. He seemed, but he was different. The Sgula element is responsible in the people, is responsible for the fulfillment of the promise that God made Abraham when the covenant ben Absorim was reached. And the Sgula element in Moses made it possible for an individual to represent the Almighty and to act as his plenipotentiary, as his representative, as his shliach, as his messenger, in order to redeem the people. Zecheir asher osa ad Hashem lekech ol Miriam. She did not recognize it. She didn't see it. But it was batere. You were marching, moving toward the promised land. Betzeischem Mitzrayim. Why were you liberated from Mitzrayim? Why were you taken out of the land of Mitzrayim? Because you had izgula potential. Because the leader who accomplished it, who represented HaKadosh Baruch Hu, possesses the Sgula potential. Not the potential, the Sgula quality. So you are going, and Miriam denied it. Remember not to deny that. That's why there is a separate animaim as far as Nevuas Meisha is concerned. As a matter of fact, the Sgula element in Moshe plays an important role halachically. Namely. Yes, what, ah? What? What did you say? I simply did not hear. No. Yes, correct. Yes, it's possible. As a novi rashoi lachadish davar. A novi, it's very strange. A novi, no other novi, can announce new laws. No other Novi can interpret the Torah. I have a right to interpret. You have a right to interpret the Torah. But the Novi should say, I interpret the Torah mi pi hadibur. I was inspired to interpret the Torah. And I do interpret the Torah in the capacity of a Novi. So the Ram says, there is a Novi Hashem. His interpretation, I mean, it's in accordance with the interpretation of the Chachomim, or the Novi Ashek of Yechonim. Only Moshe could formulate the law on behalf of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Only Moshe could legislate on behalf of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. No other Novi can do it. And I always give a very strange, I introduce a very strange example. It is a specific example. When the pasuk in Zechariah, that some people in the diaspora sent a letter, what is it? What is it? What's wrong?
Nothing.
Okay, no. There's a strange parsha in Zechariah. The parsha tells us about an inquiry which came to the Kehanim in Yerushalayim from some people in diaspora. What should they do? How should they observe the Tainiyas, like Shavuos or Betamuz, or Tisha B'Av, after the reconstruction of the Second Temple of the Beis HaMikdash? Should they continue to observe Shavuos or Betamuz and Tisha B'Av and all the tzeinis, or they should discontinue? And this inquiry was directed, addressed by the Novi to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to the Almighty. And the Almighty answered, Tzeim HaChamishi, Tzeim HaShvi, Tzeim Ovi, Tzeim HaChamishi, Tzeim HaShvi, Tzeim HaAsiri, Tzeim HaSimcha Yiyu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave instructions to Zechariah as a prophet pertaining to what? Concerning what? Concerning what? What kind of a mitzvah the Reis or a mitzvah the Rabbanan? HaKadosh Baruch Hu discusses with the Novi and gives him specific instructions how they should observe a mitzvah the Rabbanan. Isn't Enough, I mean, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu approves of the mitzvah, and he responds to an inquiry by the Novi, a very practical inquiry, whether during the Bayis Sheni, the Tanaisim should be observed or simply abandoned. So why shouldn't the Tanais, a tzibur, be raised to mitzvah min ha-teireh? You have the sanction of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There is approval. He guides the people out of there. A mitzvah de Rabbanon. It's an year. Of course the Rabbanon is going to say. The answer is, what's the answer? Because it was not through Moshe. Whatever was not decreed through Moshe will remain with the Rabbanon in Ibrahim. Even though later HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, the Almighty himself, told the people, guided the people, how to practice and how to fulfill a mitzvah de Rabbanon. This is the uniqueness of, this demonstrates the uniqueness of Moshe. He was the Nesin HaTorah from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Moshe. Now let us just pick up the scene of the Meraglim. The whole episode of the Meraglim is puzzling, the way we read it. We read it next Shabbos in Yerushalayim. All the commentators dealt already with this problem. I mean, there are many problems, many questions arise concerning the Meraglim. First, why was it necessary to send the scouts at all? What actually were they supposed to do, I mean? To report, what kind of report expected Moses from them? The report they brought did not satisfy Moses. The prima facie, not right. They said prima facie the truth. Why were they punished? Severely punished. What happened? We understand the horrible chet of the eagle, but the chet of the scout as Meraglim requires explanation. At first glance, it's an enigma. It appears to be an enigma. But I want to tell you many spoke about it. Many. All my Farshatera spoke about it. Now let me offer my pshat. There's no illusion, plain, but I believe that if you read the psukim properly in their context, and you read not only the psukim, but between the lines as well, you may guess what did the chet Meraglim consist? Why did, main problem is, why did Moshe send them? Why was it necessary? As a matter of fact, in the parsha, the scouts are not called Meraglim. They're not called Meraglim. Moreover, their mission, which they were charged with, described as Rigul. Consistently, the Bible speaks of Losso Esoret, Atorim Esoret, Vayosuru Esoret. The difference between Rigel, or Tur, or Losso or Ragel, is quite obvious. Rogel means spying, to find out the weak spot in the defense system of a potential enemy. The task of the spy is to collect military information, whatever is relevant logistically, strategically, and so forth and so on. The Bible describes what a Meraglim does. Where does the Bible describe? I said Bible. The Chumash describes. Yes, it's correct. The Bible describes an assignment of the Meraglim. Meraglim matem lires to serve as ored, but then you are spies, you came to see the nakedness of the land. You came to find the indefensible spot, the most vulnerable loci. in the land of the enemy. Nothing of that sort was entrusted to the 12 scouts, the 12 so-called explorers. The assignment spelled out by Moses did hardly deal with military information. Hardly. The only one, two words suggested are the Machni maybe Miftori. They were charged not with regular swords, but closer swords. What does closer mean? As they say, search or to explore. Yes, it's to stop. To explore. They were charged with exploring the land. It was not a military intelligence, but a study mission that he gave them. They should see the land. Who is the Masoret? And Moshe asked from them, they should submit after the return, a couple of reports. One report, a demographic report. And Rashi added, there are countries which rear strong people, and there are countries which rear weak people. There are those which produce a large population, and there are such which produce a small population. It's a plain demographic report. It's a population report. It has very little to do with military intelligence. And then the Moses says, ask also probably for an agricultural study. Moretz asher yeshev bo, atevo yimro, umoretz ashmeno yi, erozo ayesh bo etin aritz. He inquired, as I have never said, atevo yimro means in terms of climate. Ashmeno yimro in terms of the soil, fertility of the soil. Is the soil fertile? Is the climate good? And so forth and so on. In a word, Moses asked the would-be explorers to study the land and to submit a report, the results of the study. And the study did not, it completely was almost unconcerned with military problems or intelligence data. So why did he send them? Why was it necessary? I mean, to say that Moshe was looking for intelligence data would be ridiculous. I mean, when they went out of Mitzrayim, they had no intelligence service. Not even, and still they went out of Mitzrayim. The Moshe knew very well that the entrance of the soil would be accompanied by miracles, by HaKadosh Baruch Hu's help and support, as the Exodus law. So why was it necessary, I mean, to send them to collect intelligence data? As a matter of fact, he didn't collect intelligence data. But he told them to study the land and the people on the land. I mean, the flora, I mean, the population. Why was it necessary? In my opinion, Moses acted in accordance with a certain halacha. The certain halachic principle. And please don't laugh and I'll say it. I'll explain it. The Gemara says, Osu le'lodom le'kadish isho achi yireno. The law requires that one must not betroth, let alone wed a woman he does not know, no matter how highly recommended she was to him. Where is the aloha? We can find this aloha in Chumash. What's after him? What's got to do with after Hakamecha? What's got to do with after Hakamecha? On the contrary. Yeah, Eliezer Rivka. Fine. No. No. Thank you. But if the blind person puts the stumbling block in his way, not someone else. In Posuk, in fact, the story about Eliezer and Rebecca concerns this law. And I want to tell you why. The Bible tells us, Vaisaper Oeved Yitzchok es kol hadvorim asher osa, Vayiveer Yitzchok oher lo soro imei, Vayikach es rivka. Even though Eliezer told what transpired on his trip to Choron, notwithstanding Eliezer's portrayal of Rebecca in the most glorious terms, such as wisdom, intelligence, hospitality, and kindness, Isaac did not take care of her wife immediately. This is the way Rashi interprets. He introduced her into the tent. He ushered her in into the tent of Sarah. It was before Kedushin and before Nisri. Why did he bring her into the tent of Sarah? She had to pass a test. Namely, what kind of a test? If she is the worthy successor to Sarah, whether she will restore the glory and the pristine beauty of the heir, whether she can take the place of Sarah. Yitzchak did not rush. She was in no hurry to marry or to betroth or to wed her. Yitzchak and he brought her into the tent. He wanted to see. Will the same cloud return? Will the Issa, the Dao rise? Will the mayor be relieved? What happened? Sorrow in it. Rasha said, Hariki Sorrow. Everything came back. Everything. He saw the cloud, the light, the candle was released, the lighter. Then, when he found out, he was convinced that Sorrow in it, Vayikach es Risko Leisho, Vayikach es Risko, Vatilo Leisho Vayorel. This is the aloha of Osol Odom. He heard from Eliezer. Eliezer was an expert. Eliezer was trustworthy. Eliezer was devoted and loyal to them. Yes, correct. But he didn't steal. He did not betroth or wed her until he himself became convinced that she is the equal of Sarah. Rest as Vayivero Eliyahu, the Nasi's dugma sorrow in me. And she turned, her image turned, I mean, into the image of Sarah. Kleimar varehi soin, she is like so. Now let me understand. Oh, this is Allah. Let me understand Allah. What's behind it? What's behind it? Eliezer is trustworthy. Abraham said about Eliezer, Ameshel b'chol ha'shalei. He was the manager of his household, and Abraham trusted Eliezer. Eliezer apparently was very loyal and very devoted to Abraham. Eliezer told him a promise. He told him about Rebecca and her wisdom, her hospitality and kindness, about her mannerism and so forth, her piety and commitment. That means to know her well. Why is it necessary? The answer is simple. Marriage is not just an ordinary transaction. It is not just a civil commitment or a utilitarian mundane partnership. It is an existential commitment, a personalistic covenant. Two lonely people, for as long as if there's no marriage, person is lonely, they think they are brought on the body. Two lonely people, souls joined, two strangers decide to unite destinies, to share in the same fate, to be together, to suffer and to rejoice together, and to travel together and to pay the toll of the road jointly. In order to take on such an all-inclusive, all-encompassing encompassing commitment, one cannot trust anybody. One must know that the woman whom he dedicates his life intimately and well. Intimately and well, vice versa. There's a Isha and the Isha most probably not to marry an Ish whom she doesn't know. I would say it's a reversible equation. Had marriage been just a civil institution, not an existential covenantal union, first-hand personal information and knowledge would be unnecessary. Marriage is more than a conventional, practical institution, civil institution. It is something, there is something metaphysical. It's again oneness of two people. It's again the union of two souls. The mixing of destinies or the union of them. The merger of destiny. And that's why you don't rely on the head, on the matter. How loyal he was. We are told in Baal Yitzchok, the parsha preceding Shlach, we read it last Sabbath, that the Jews, with Moses that they had, who were ready to invade Eretz Yisrael. We are told in Baal Yitzchok that Moses invited his father-in-law Yisrael to join the people on their march to the promised land. The entry to Eretz Israel, that's what we have to understand, it was not just a physical act of crossing the Jordan River or of climbing up the hills, the plateau in the south. It was more than that. To Moses, it meant more than that. It was a marriage between a people and a land. A land and a people became wedded to each other. A union of the rocky hills and the sandy trails with a people who was returning to its origin, which he left centuries ago, centuries before. We don't know exactly how many years our ancestors spent in Israel. The entry meant that land and people are to be fused into one singular existence. The entry signifies destiny of a people united with the destiny of a land. People and land became one. That's what the entry of Israel meant. People and land will share joy and grief, honor and shame, victory and defeat together. For how long? It's a funny marriage. Marriage, I mean, death part, the husband and the wife. But here is the Rambam passage, Kitzel is Aito, the Kitzel was his mother. It was in marriage forever. Consequently, the people could not just enter the land without meeting her. The groom could not enter the land without meeting first, knowing the land intimately. They knew it was a Haaretz Zoval Kol Oved Vosh. Yes, correct, they knew about it, but they had to experience. They had to get acquainted intimately with the land before the land and people became united. That's why Moshe, a short time before the entry, the planned entry into the promised land, sent explorers to study the land, not to gather intelligence data. It's completely unnecessary. To explore and to report back to the people. We send the would-be groom to meet and to see the would-be bride. Aluze Banegev, Zalise Mesor, Urise Mesor, it's Mai. He didn't tell them what. Mai! Because we are going to unite destinies forever. Because we are going to unite destinies forever. Well, I mean, if we read the Chumash, I mean, superficially, the question arises, why was it necessary for Moshe to give them instructions how to travel to Eretz Israel? That's completely irrelevant. They knew it with the road. They knew the highway, whatever there was, the trail. They would have found, they would have known the road leading to the promised land anywhere. In my opinion, and I beg you to pay attention here, in my opinion, Moses revealed to the explorers the reason why he sent them and what their mission consists of. But in order to understand the Maluze Banegev, Baalisem Esor, we have to turn the pages back to Vayeshev. Vayeshev in the story of Joseph being sent by Jacob to inquire about the welfare of his brothers in Shechem, the Pasuk says, Vayemalei Leichno Rehe Eshleim Achechof, the Shleim Atzein, Vashivenu Dobo, Vayishalcheyu Meimek Hevrein, Vayovi Shemo. Go, I pray thee, see if peace be with the brethren. So he sent him out of the veil, or the depression, or the death of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. Rashi. I mean, says something which prima facie appears to be puzzling. Meimek Hevrin? Vale Hevrin Boa? Hevrin is not in a valley. Hevrin is on a plateau. Shenemar Aluze Banegev? Or Vayalu Banegev Ayovi at Hevrin? Elo meitzo amuko sholeitzo tzadik. Akobu bechevrein lekayim ashenema l'avromo vino ben apsorin ki geir yizaracho beret l'ilayim. I'm quoting not the Medrash Priya, but Rashi. I believe many of you know the Rashi. How do you interpret the Rashi? Rashi saw in the words Eimek Hevrin, it's a Medrash basically. Eimek Hevrin, great symbolism. Eimek is a veil, a valley, a depression. One who stands, who finds himself in the valley, over which tall mountains tower, shutting out daylight, or a very deep depression, shutting out daylight or sunshine, can see very little. Very little. He lives in shadow. His field of vision is very limited. On the contrary, a person standing on the peak of a mountain is capable to encompass with his glance a very large area. His field of vision is enormous. Standing on the plateau, on the peak of the mountain, he can observe and see things which he could not see while he was in the valley. New horizons revealed to him. When you climb up a mountain, a tall mountain, you suddenly see new horizons, a new scenery, a new landscape, charming, attractive to me. Vayishlochei umeim ek chevre. What does it mean? Rashi asked a question. Chevre was in a plateau. He's in a plateau. Uvai is called me. Vayishlochei umeim ek chevre. What does it mean? How did he send him from the depression of Hebron? Very simple. Jacob accompanied Joseph down the hill, down the mountain, into the depression, into the veil. He didn't just send Joseph, he accompanied him. A part of the road, down the slope, into the depression of heaven. Then he came into the valley, or into the depression, then Jacob gave Joseph, bade him farewell, and he sent him to his brothers to Shechem to inquire about their welfare. Why did Jacob accompany Joseph? After all, it was probably, I'm not an expert on the geography, in particular topography of Eretz Israel, but it's quite a distance. Why did he? This was the Ashgoche wanted it. Paul Ashgoche was responsible. Why? Because there was great symbolism in Jacob's accompanying Joseph down the hill, down the slope of the hill, into the depression. Jacob was completely unaware what consequences this errand will produce. He was in a valley. He didn't see too far. Jacob had instincts. Intuition, his outlook, his glance, embraced, I mean, an enormous area, yes, but not this time, not on that day. Jacob had inspiration, or his incisive intuition, he wouldn't have sent Joseph at all. He knew very well the sentiments, what sentiments the brothers, harbor vis-a-vis Joseph. He knew very well that Joseph is disliked. And to send Joseph to Shechem to inquire about the health and the welfare of his brother was foolhardy. But Jacob was unaware of it. Jacob did not know two things: that we will not see Joseph for the next 22 years. This was the last time he saw Joseph. Second, the Golas Mitzrayim has begun the very moment Jacob kissed Joseph goodbye, gave him the last hug, and sent Jacob to Shechem. He sent him to Shechem, but actually Jacob was not sent to Shechem. Joseph was not sent to Shechem. Where was Joseph sent? To Mitzrayim. He was in a valley. Very McHevry. Had Jacob been on the peak of the mountain, as he usually was on the plateau, because his outlook was clear on him. As Chazal said, he had Ruach HaKodesh, inspiration. Had he been inspired, nothing would have happened. would have never lost Joseph. But he descended this Joseph from the peak of the mountain into the valley, into the depression. And his view became obscured, and he sent Joseph. And descending Joseph, precipitated the Golis Mitzrayim. Joseph was the first exile who left Eretz Yisrael, and came into Mitzrayim. And Jacob was the next. Jacob lost his vision. He's inside the situation. He overlooked realities and acted in ignorance of the result which this errand will produce. And now Moses said, what Jacob has started is going to be consummated now. Moses told the 12 would-be explorers, go up in the south to the same place where the great covenant uniting people lands in matrimony. Valisemesor, climb up the same mount from which Jacob descended into the valley of Hebron. He was chosen by the Ashgoche to be the first covenantal exile to live in the veil of Hebron, in the shadows cast by the hills surrounding the veil. He was elected to be the first to rescind the union of clan and land, because by sending Joseph, Jacob precipitated what kind of a process? Of separation of clan and land, or people and land. What happened for centuries, the land was completely deserted by the household of Jacob. The household of Jacob and its descendants, were in Mitzrayim. So Jacob, by sending Joseph to inquire, to see his brothers, has started the process of what? Of separation of clan and land. That's what Joseph said. And this is described in Bereishis as if Jacob descended from Joseph, from the plateau, from the peak of the hill, down into the depth, into the Mamakim of Hebron. Because Jewish history, was the history of Jewish exile started at the very moment Joseph turned his back on Jacob. And now Moses said, however, Moses said, we are elected to be another, to carry out another assignment, a much more pleasant and joyful one. We are about to climb up the mount, to start on the peak of the mount, and to cast a searching glance. We belong not to the waiting generation. Generation after generation waited for the Gula, for the return of the people to the land. We belong not to the waiting generation, but we are a fulfilling generation. And in contradistinction to Jacob, we will embrace with one look the entire landscape, the grandeur of the land. You will realize immediately what our relationship. You'll understand our relationship to the land. We are not looking for a land only in a material, political sense, for a physical home. We are trying to restore an existential, exalted, marital union. The land has been wedded to us, and our destiny and the destiny of the land merged. We feel the suffering of the land, and when it's occupied by strangers, the land shares in our plight, in distress, in exile. Valisem valuze boho, go up. Proud, thankful, joyful, aware of the great era which will commence now with your ascension, the era of fulfillment. Chazal already spoke of the Oreish Rashi, where the Oreish Bekeil Shadoi, where Avram Yitzchok Yanke Bekeil Shadoi, the Rashi says, Iftachti Veleke Yamti. It was an era of promise, and an era of waiting, and an era of faith. I mean, the Oreish had to, I mean, had this faith, superhuman faith in the word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And Moses' era, Chazal called, era of fulfillment. This is Shem Havayeh, fulfillment. That's when Moses said to the Meraglim, go up the mountain. Jacob came down the mountain. You go up, climb up the mountain. You will see something which Jacob did not see. You will see that the people return to the land. Urihisem esoret. Mahi. What did Moses expect them to report? What did Moses expect them to report? What did Moses expect them to report? What did Moses want the miracle to do? What kind of report? That is, Aluze Baneges Valise Mesor Uriise Mesoret Mahi. Later he gave them secondary instructions about fertility, about population, about climate, but what was the primary instruction? This is the primary instruction comes to expression in the first sentence. Aluze Banegev, go up the Negev. Because the Negev, the cradle of Jewish history, was in the Negev. The revelation to Abraham was in the Negev. That Brisbane Absori most probably was in the Negev. I mean, the Negev pulled Abraham by ear. Olech v'noseya negva, aluze v'negev. This is the spot which pulled our ancestors. This is the spot where the great covenant was concluded between men, God, and land. Alisha Mesor. And now reverse Jacob's movement. Not from the peak of the mountain into the depression, but from the valley unto the peak of the mountain. And when you stand at the peak of the mountain, you'll see something which you don't know. You'll see the land. What does it mean? Yeah, what really is. Hence, what does it mean? No. That is. It behooves us to unite our destiny with the land. Urihisem esor etzmai means that the land is worthy of waiting and of uniting with Israel. Urihisem esor etzmai, you see the land that only there the people can realize the great potential. Because basically, Meshe, what is the most outstanding quality of Eretz Yisrael in Chazal? What's the most outstanding quality in Chazal and Eretz Yisrael? Ashchino Shruya be'Eretz Yisrael. In Ashchino Shruya b'Chutzlan. There is no Nevuah in Chutzlan. After all, the task of the Jewish people is to be Miyitin, Kol Amad Hashem Yidin, that everyone and everybody should be inspired by the Spirit of God. And this can happen only in this world. When Jonah did not want to escape, flee from the Hakadosh Baruch Hu, he got on board of a ship which was moving toward Kutra. And you see that the land is worthy of our sacrifices, of our waiting, and of our faith and hope. My be the quality of the land. It means you should recognize the element of Zgula in Eretz Yisrael, the uniqueness of Eretz Yisrael, and the singularity. And the uniqueness and singularity of Eretz Yisrael somehow can be united with the element of Zgula, uniqueness and singularity of the people. We send them to Eretz Yisrael. Send them because also Lodom the Kadeshishu Achirana. You wanted them to see that the land is worthy of the people. What did they do? Vayalu Banegev, Vayove Achevret. 11 explorers did not care even to enter Hebron, the way Chazal interpreted. They certainly did not go up the mountain, don't say Vayalu Bahor. From which Jacob descended into the veil. We did not get a comprehensive view of the land. There was no revelation of the exalted grandeur and beauty of the glory of the land. They just explored it piecemeal, in a piecemeal fashion, in a deliberate manner. They did not understand this gulo charisma of the land and of the people. The land was replaceable, and so if the land is replaceable, dispensable, so is the people. It was just a land. They never reported back to Moses concerning the mission of Rishemes Oretz Mai. What is unique about the land? Does it fit or doesn't it fit? Is it worthy of united, of being united with her, or the land is unworthy of an eternal union? This they left out. Only call it when Yeshua said something. Stay Lord, maybe. But his word, it behooves us to wear the land. Or to be united in an insoluble union. We have no other land. Our destiny is linked up with the destiny of the land. That's exactly what the Medrash Tanchume quoted by Rashi Men when he said that the Meraglim should have taken a lesson from her. Not a lesson of Lashon Hara, in not engaging in slander or Lashon Hara. What did Miriam overlook? This Gula element in Moshe. What did they overlook? This Gula element in the land. And that's why they were so severely punished. Miriam ignored the choiceness of her brother, Moses. His numinous character, charisma. She compared him with herself and Aaron, even though she admitted his superiority. The spies, likewise, could not grasp the secret of Eretz Gula in its unique metaphysical relationship to the people. there was a common denominator in both episodes. In her protest against Moses, and in their report submitted to Moses, namely, the element Asus Gula was absent somehow. And if one does not believe in school law, he cannot simply act in faith and cannot wait for the school law. Then the element of Zgula applies actually in Yahadus to many situations, the element of Zgula. In our hierarchy of values, of course we have lower values and higher values, we have less exalted and more exalted values, we have less precious and more precious values. Like in any hierarchy of values, there's always a problem of conflict, a problem of priority of values, and a problem of choice, of choosing values. But in our hierarchy of values, we have also school of values. You cannot say they are superior or inferior. They are different. Namely, could you mention to me certain halachic institutions which have the element of school of Shabbos, correct? Shabbos is not just holy year, then all human beings. Chemdas Yomi makes a korosa. What does Chemdas Yomi mean? I mean, you don't know, it means skula, unique, singular. Shabbos is singular. Yom Tov is not singular. Yom Tov in the Kaddish Yisrael Vazmanim, all Yom Tov come under Vazmanim. There is no individuality. There is sanctity, Kedushas Hayim. There is no uniqueness, no singularity. Shabbos is Chemdas Yomi makes a korosa. Shabbos. There is a hole in school. But actually, the element of Zgula we find where. Because if Zgula is something great, something precious, fundamental in Yahadus, Moses had the element of Zgula. The Moshiach, Messiah, will have the element of Zgula. Malchus the David is an element of Zgula. Am Yisroel has the element of Zgula. Shabbat and Shabbos has element of Zgula, but his Zgula is to be found in Be'er Elam. The Be'er Elam, and the Rambam has repeated it many times, the Almighty is not only one, but he is the only one. Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad is not only one, God is one, certainly it is, but it's more than that. God is the only one, the single one. Maimonides emphasizes and re-emphasizes the great mystery of faith. On the one hand, God is the origin of everything. Wherever one finds being, he finds the Almighty. Eye, Asher Eye. It means wherever there is existence, the Almighty presence. If one exists, if I exist, you exist, it's because we do exist in the Almighty. Without the Almighty, there's no existence, there's no being. This is the mystery of Eyash Reyes. The world is in him. He embraces the world. To exist means to be in the heart of eternity, if I may use an existentialist phrase, but it's a correct phrase. Whoever is heart embraced by eternity, by the Almighty exists. There is unity between creation and creator. On the other hand, God is alone, different in the ultimate sense of the word, from the world, different from the world. as a matter of fact, God not only created the world, not only God sustains the world, he also negates the world. He negates all beings. He is exclusively, he is a yochid. If there is being, it is only the true being of the Almighty. No one can imitate HaKadosh Baruch Hu or say that he shares in divine being. His divine being is exclusive. No one is like him. Consequently, our existence is just a dream, just a hoax. We basically do nothing. The Halenios, when you read the Bible in Kidra, you see, it's an illusion. It's a very enchanting illusion. And a very dangerous illusion. But it is an illusion. But there is only one way to be. This HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We have already in the approach of Yahadus to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there's both elements. One element, HaKadosh Baruch Hu supports the world. He is close to the world. He is near the world. And all the world has to do is to learn from HaKadosh Baruch Hu how to act, how to exist, how to live. On the other hand, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Yochid. He only exists, no one else. Usually, we come close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When a finite being comes close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it is, we reach, I mean, he actually stops, he discontinues to exist. It is when finitude is added up to infinity. It's what you have in mathematics. You have infinity, finitude. So the HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Echot, and there is communication between him and the world, but the HaKadosh Baruch Hu is also Yochid in a moment. There is no communication because there is no world. But they are the Kunizea says, and Kulei Kamandalesata. The whole world as if the world did not exist. From the standpoint, from the viewpoint, Kavi Yoko HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Since man was created in the image of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the terrible King Borei says, the man also is a dialectical existence. He is a part of the universal order as well as a single school individual. We may compare man with other creatures, with the brute in the field, and with the tree in the forest, but at the same time, man remains an outsider, a stranger, who has nothing in common with nature. He's a part of the universal order, he's also sometimes confronted with the universal order. Moreover, within society, the relationship between man and man plays a dual role. He is told, on the one hand, by the Torah, to open up, to practice chesed. What does chesed mean? To open up. To tear down the barriers surrounding the ego-centric individual, to let others enter his private lodging and share everything with him. Man is told to practice chesed. What is chesed? It's not in open existence. From Yuvon Yeshis Pesach Leil, Kechem Ayin. On the other hand, man is also urged by the Torah to guard his uniqueness. His singular endowment is being alone, unattached, unmedbar and unparalleled, completely submerged in the I-existence awareness. None leads upon the others, or is supposed to lead, in two reshuyas. Shabbat, we have three reshuyas. The reshus HaRabim and the reshus HaYochid. If a man continues to lead the reshus HaYochid, he becomes an egotist, finally. If he continues to lead the reshus HaRabim, he loses his cool element and becomes an imitator, nothing else. He loses his originality, his inspiration. Moses was the great leader. Who on the one hand was one of the crowd. He suffered for the many. I mean, leadership in Yahadut is always measured by the capacity of the individual to suffer for the masses, for the crowd. If you take the suffering of the crowd and you add up, one to one, the leader takes over the sum total of this suffering. The capacity to suffer for millions, this is the first prerequisite for the leader. Not to be glorified by millions. This is a Gentile ideal, a pagan ideal. The pagan hero, the Jewish hero is the individual suffering for millions, these millions. He suffered for the many. When there was the problem of the ego, what did Moses offer up for this book and suggested? Just erase my name from your book. He sacrificed his life, his very existence for his people. He lived an open life, all encompassing, all loving. He did not display his glory when he dealt with simple people. He couldn't, this Moses was never lonely. He couldn't be lonely. He was the people. Vayim emochav, vayeshev meshe vishpet et om, surrounded by people in the midst of the crowd. And he personifies all the dreams, all the hopes, and all the desires of the people. He suffered with them, he rejoiced with them. However, there was a school element in Moses. It's very important. He was lonely. Lived for himself, and at times he could not communicate with the people, with others. Since he led his Gula existence, which is not communicable. The singular existence, inimitable, unmatched, particularly incomprehensible to others. How can there be communication between the people and Moses, if Moses is unique, single, no one is like him? And Moses was the loneliest person on earth. Umeshe yikach esroel, the notary semechut lamachane. Is it the same Meshe? Uvayeshev Meshe lishpet esom, vayamed om al Meshe minateker ad oeres? Or two Meshe, same Moshe. Meshe was Reshus HaYochid. Meshe was Reshus HaRabin as well. And he was Reshus HaRabin, he merged with the people. And he was Reshus HaYochid, he was alone. Just communicated with what? With the Bereot, with his creator. This mode of existence, which is rooted in the idea of Malach Pedrochov, finds its complete harmony in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as far as human beings are concerned.
we are dialectical beings. Wherever, if you'll just be mixed, wherever this Gula element is present, one cannot rationalize it then. As an example, I can give you the situation in Eretz Yisrael now. Basically, our attachment to Eretz Yisrael and our faithfulness to the land, which is incomprehensible, simply, is in logical terms. Unless we try to interpret it in metalogical terms, but I frankly know very little about metalogical categories. In logical categories, is this closeness of people to land after 1900 years of exile is maddening. Simply maddening. And don't forget that American Jews are doing now things out of a sense of devotion which may endanger their own security status in the land. American Jew is usually a rational Jew, very practical Jew, very utilitarian minded, and pragmatically oriented. And now when I look at the same Jews with their excitement about this world, with their readiness to attack anybody, be the President of the United States, if it says something which is not in the spirit of Zionism, I begin to think, where's the logos? Where's the reason? Where's the practicality? He's a manufacturer, the other one is a banker. I mean, after all, he's a value of business. The turnover in his business accounts in which is tens of millions of dollars. He has a clear mind. Many of them I know personally, clear mind. Why becomes his mind clouded when Eretz Yisrael is placed on the agenda? Why do you want to go into to see Eretz Yisrael with the eyes of a Jew? Because our relationship to Eretz Yisrael is that of Zgula. Wherever Zgula comes to the forefront, the foreground, ratio, resigns. You cannot rationalize events which revolve about Zgula. There is an element of the numinous, of the frighteningly strange, of the hidden and ineffable in the Zgula Charisma. Soon the problems begin, to pile up. Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu choose us as an Am Zgula? It's a puzzle. Why was Eretz Yisrael selected the land of the Am Zgula? And was in doubt with the Zgula quality. This remains an enigma. Why is an Am Zgula supposed to live in exile? Hundreds of years is difficult. We fail to grasp. When values are comparable, when common denominator unite many values, the mind is capable to rationalize. However, as I stress, Zgula is beyond and above the capacity of the logos to comprehend. Certain times, the Zgula element is in background. Then history is simple to understand. At other times, it's very hard to distinguish. The Zgula element is in front. Is visible somehow. There is a revelation of this Gula element. At the very moment this Gula element reveals itself, Am's Gula, Eretz Gula, Meshes Gula, then the enigma rises and everything becomes mysterious. This Gula element cannot be understood. It could be only lived and experienced. Will make the faith. It cannot be conceived through the intellect, through the intellectual gesture. We know snu al tzitzis hakonos, still trainers. The Hoyer Lochem Lititi. That they put with the fringe of each corner a thread of blue. And it shall be unto you for a fringe that you may look upon, eat, and remember. Trainers in Lovon, plain semantically, as far as Hebrew semantics are concerned, white and blue, either sky blue or sea blue, symbolize in Hebrew semantics two ideas. Lovon means the known. When you say in Hebrew, you say it is plain and obvious, you say Vadova Mechuva. Vadova Mechuva. Chuva. The white color is in Hebrew semantics is symbolic of human understanding. The comprehensible, the clear and distinct, paraphrasing a sentence by Descartes, I would say, he said that the criterion of truth, how do I know that what I said is true, perhaps it's false, the whole problem which the Greeks confronted, Descartes said there is no objective criterion, but there is a subjective criterion. I doubt whether he was right. If a man is convinced, has an inner conviction that this is true, and the idea is clear and distinct in his mind, clear and distinct. It's clearness, clarity, and distinctiveness of the idea are the criteria of truth. Paraphrasing this saying by Descartes, I would say that white is the criterion of truth. But white means whatever is clear and distinctive and understood and comprehensible in my mind. Blue, on the contrary, the way Chazal has described blue. Blue, on the contrary, is indicative, according to Chazal. Chere deime le yam, yam deime le rokia, rokia deime le kise akovei. What does it mean? What does blue symbolize? Distance. Boundless distances. Like the sky or the vast stretches of water. As far as the sea is concerned. The distance, the remote, whatever is outside of one's reach, the perennial enigma, the sgula quality, is symbolized by our historical experience, the paradoxical unfolding of our destiny. All that is symbolized by blue. A Jew apparently is expected to focus his glance on the white and attempt to understand. The Torah was always encouraged men to understand the world. The Torah did not want people to live in obscurity. The Torah did not want people simply not to explore, all the phenomena of nature, they're encouraged. Seven threads of the teachers are white. Man should use his ratio, should use his mind, and make discoveries, be scientifically oriented, and technologically minded. As long as it revolves about the white color. No. As long as the world is given to man, man can explore the world. He is urged to explore the world. He'll do more to keep sure. And he should use his mind. He uses his mind. This is the white color. Man should use his intellect. On the other hand, there is one thread, is blue. once it blooms in the citrus, man meets with a mystery sometimes, with something luminous, something awesome, beyond the bounds of the rational and intelligible. We encounter unexpectedly the Sgula quality. Everything becomes distant and strange. Remote as the sky, and actually distant from our mind. But we have been trained to accept both. If we are, if the experience is understandable, then our intellect interprets the experience. If the experience is not understandable and unintelligible, we interpret it through an act of faith. Which makes the sadness come to the same.